Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Back in 2007, then-President George W. Bush began his State of the Union address with this.
Tonight, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of my own as the first president to begin the State of the Union message with these words. Madam Speaker.
Now Nancy Pelosi wants that title again, but not everyone in her party is on board. This hour on Point, Nancy Pelosi and the leadership fight in Congress. And later in the hour, what's behind GM's big layoffs and the latest from the U.S.-Mexican border. Join us. We'd love to have you. Is Nancy Pelosi the right person for the job? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Molly Ball joins me first from Washington. She's national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Molly, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
A lot of drama amid the rebellion by some Democrats who want Nancy Pelosi to step aside. Talk us through some of the negotiations right now, Molly.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's a little bit anticlimactic, and there is somewhat less drama than might have been anticipated ahead of the leadership vote. This is a closed-door vote of the Democratic caucus conducted in private by secret ballot, and that is to decide who the caucus chooses as its speaker candidate, as its leader, as its leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actual vote on the floor, which officially in which members of Congress officially vote for the Speaker of the House, that is in January. So the fact that the vote is being held now is already somewhat of a concession.
Mm-hmm.
You will recall that the caucuses, both caucuses in the Senate and the Republican caucus in the House, have already chosen their leaders. But Nancy Pelosi agreed to put off this vote for several weeks after the election to give new members a time to make decisions, and as a sort of concession to the her many critics within the caucus. But what we've seen her do since then is really put on a sort of bravura display of her abilities as a politician. She has relentlessly lobbied all of the members of her caucus. She has summoned every possible activist group on the left side of the spectrum, from the far left to the center, all of them coming out to express support for her, or almost all. And while 2 years ago, in her bid for Democratic leader, she did have an opponent, Representative Tim Ryan, and he got about a third of the caucus to vote for him in that leadership vote. This time, no one has declared that they are running against her, and so it's hard to lose an election in which you're unopposed. And so there has been a letter by 16 Democrats who said they would not vote for her on the floor. But that's the floor vote that comes in January. And if she's already won the caucus vote at that time, then the pitch becomes different. Then the pitch becomes her saying to members, are you really going to vote for a Republican when that's the alternative? Or are you going to support Pelosi once she's the choice of the caucus?
Here is Congressman Anthony Brown, a Democrat from Maryland, on Morning Joe on MSNBC last week explaining why he is a stalwart Pelosi supporter.
We need to put our most experienced field marshals on the field in the 116th Congress to go toe-to-toe with Mitch McConnell in the Senate, with the president and the administration. We've got a lot of important and will prove to be difficult work to do. So we need our very best, our very most experienced.
And here is Massachusetts Democrat Seth Moulton after the midterms on MSNBC calling for new leadership to replace Nancy Pelosi.
The American people sent a very clear message in the election last week that they want new approaches to politics and new leaders in Washington. If we answer that call for new leadership by reinstalling the same status quo establishment leadership that we've had in this party since 2006, then we're letting down the American people. And the overwhelming majority of Democrats want new leadership in the House of Representatives.
status quo establishment leadership. Talk about this test, Molly Ball, of Nancy Pelosi's ability to balance the wishes of more moderate Democrats against this aggressive new crop of young progressives who want to see change and who seem more interested in confrontation than compromise.
Well, I think it is not so much an ideological as a generational conflict.
Right.
A lot of the new members who are elected are moderates elected from swing districts, but a lot of them are from a younger generation, many first-time candidates. But with all due respect to Congressman Moulton, the signal that the voters sent in the election was that they wanted Democrats in control of the House of Representatives. And despite Republicans putting tens of millions of dollars into a campaign against Nancy Pelosi specifically, she has been for years the main target of Republicans' attacks. Their election argument being, if you elect this Democrat in your district, no matter how nice they may seem, they're going to put the terrible Nancy Pelosi in charge. That fell flat. The voters didn't go for that argument. The Democrats are slated for, when all the votes are counted, a historic mm-hmm. victory, the biggest vote margin since Watergate, a 40-seat pickup. So it's hard to say that the message that the voters sent was somehow against what the Democrats are offering. Now, there is a lot of angst, and I don't want to understate it. There is a lot of angst in the Democratic ranks about the fact that despite the fact that there is all this fresh energy in the lower rungs of the party, the leaders in Congress, which is now the only thing that they will control in Washington, are all above 70. And
right. Nancy Pelosi, 78. Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, 79. Number three leader in the House, James Clyburn, 78. I mean, talk about a generation gap.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And because Nancy Pelosi has for so many years frozen out any threats to her power, that has really prevented a new generation from rising up. Mm-hmm. And it has frustrated a lot of up and coming Democrats.
Let me get some calls in here. My board is lit up. Chris in Lewiston, Maine. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I'm about as far left wing liberal as you get. And I know Nancy Pelosi is an amazing leader, and she really, truly is probably the best person equipped to manage the House. But we Democrats were just insanely blind to optics. I mean, we need a new generation to come up. We need new blood to appear on the scene so that they can be the leaders of tomorrow. And right now, you can't name on one hand the new leaders other than Ocasio.
Who do you see? Who do you want in there, Chris?
Well, see, that's the problem. I don't know, because we just don't have anybody moving up the ladder.
All right, Chris, thank you. Let's get Donna in here from Charleston, New Hampshire. Hi, Donna, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that I believe Nancy Pelosi is the most qualified candidate for Speaker of the House. I don't understand this idea that we need new blood. Nancy Pelosi brought us national health insurance. Mm-hmm. The other comment I want to make is that this is straight out of the Republican playbook of misogynistically vilifying very competent women, such as Hillary Clinton, and that this is the best thing that can possibly happen is to put her right in the face of that, because she can handle it.
Donna, thank you very much. Molly Ball, jump in here. You know, there's Chris, there's Donna, very different perspectives. Nancy Pelosi has been the Republican boogeyman or boogeywoman, if you will, for a long time. Is she a political liability at this point for some members in her caucus in the House?
I think she probably is. But I think your caller's really succinctly illuminated both sides of the argument here, because there's a couple of jobs that the Speaker of the House has. There's politics and there's policy. And when it comes to the politics, when it comes to being the face of the party, inspiring people, being dynamic, convincing people that Democrats are where it's at and that Democrats represent the future, Nancy Pelosi's probably not the best person for that. Mm-hmm. And I think actually former President Obama said a version of this last week. But when it comes to policy, when it comes to actually doing the perhaps lost art of actually legislating, getting a caucus to come together around the fine points of very complicated legislation, negotiating with Republicans, whether in the House or in the Senate or in the White House, it's actually pretty remarkable what she was able to get done with Republicans controlling all the branches of government, even in the House minority. She has secured all kinds of Democratic victories in the spending bills that have been enacted, protecting Democratic priorities and negotiating with Republicans. And the show she's putting on right now, showing how she can wear down her own members, give them what they want, negotiate with them, pick them off one by one, as she's done already with some of the signatories of this letter.
Like flies, yeah.
It really shows that skill that she has for just doggedly getting stuff done, which isn't something that a lot of people in Washington know how to do anymore.
Here she is, Nancy Pelosi on CNN State of the Union this weekend, telling host Dana Bash what she learned growing up in a political family in Baltimore.
One is to know how to count. That's very important. Count your votes to win the election. Count your votes to win a vote on the floor. But the other is listen to the constituents.
Listen to the constituents. Luke is in Savannah, Georgia. Luke, what do you think on this?
Well, my opinion, I've lived all over the world, and I don't see it in America like I see it in other countries. If you lose a devastating election, the general election to Trump, for example, why is there not new leadership coming forward? If the leadership of the Democratic Party was not able to pull off a general election, why are there not more new faces? It's mind-boggling.
You sound like Chris earlier. Luke, thank you so much. One more David in Oklahoma City. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I look at Pelosi along the same lines as Hillary Clinton. Sadly, some of my Democratic friends and all of my Republican friends, when Hillary's mentioned it, oh, she's a crook, she's a criminal. And I'm like, give me an example. And they flounder. And I think that the Republican Party has so vilified Pelosi that people aren't even sure why she's being vilified. They just see her as evil. And she is the best thing. She might be the most successful member of Congress in terms of getting an agenda passed ever in the history of Congress.
So. David, thank you so much for the call. Molly Ball, just a few seconds left here. Boy, we run the gamut on those calls there on perspectives about Nancy Pelosi. What's the future here? Does she have the votes, do you think, at this point to become Speaker again?
Not yet, but she's getting pretty close, and it's starting to feel inevitable. You've heard some of the talk, and even Congressman Moulton in that clip, who was one of the most aggressive opponents of Pelosi for Speaker, has now said he's willing to negotiate with her. We'll see if she's willing to negotiate with him, but that's pretty much a capitulation.
Great explainer. And Molly Ball, thank you so much for your time. National political correspondent for Time Magazine in Washington. Molly, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we look at why General Motors is shuttering 5 plants, laying off some 14,000 workers in the U.S. and Canada. We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think GM's announcement spells trouble for the broader American economy? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the balanced scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. General Motors announced yesterday it will close 5 plants and lay off thousands of workers in the United States and Canada. Labor unions are not happy. The president is not happy. But GM says it is girding itself for big changes in the automotive market and a coming economic downturn. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know about the GM decision? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Joining me from Youngstown, Ohio is Michelle Nix, reporter for NBC affiliate 21 News WFMJ. Michelle, thanks for making the time today and welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. From Youngstown.
Thank you. From Los Angeles, where he's attending the L.A. Auto Show, Sam Abuelsamid. He's a senior analyst at Navigant Research in Detroit and a former automotive product development engineer. Sam, welcome to you. Good to have you.
Glad to be with you today.
Michelle, let's start with you. So GM cutting up to 14,000 factory and white-collar jobs. What plants are closing and where?
Okay, we have a GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio, and that will affect about 1,600 workers here, but they had already laid off 2 shifts. They only had 1 shift working still, but those other 2 shifts had hoped to be coming back to work at some point. We're told that they are cutting the Cruze production. The Chevy Cruze will stop production as of March 1st. And they are not being allocated another product, so they will be in non-allocation status as of March 1st. Without another product, they will not have jobs and not have anything to go back to. They are not being told that the plant is closed, but, of course, they really have not a lot of hope at this point of getting another product, although the workers are saying they are still hopeful. They are still hoping that President Trump can step in and do something. They are hoping that Governor-elect Mike DeWine can step in and talk to these GM executives and get something rolling. They are just hoping that after 52 years with this historic plant, that this isn't the end of the road for GM Lordstown.
So Lordstown in Warren, Ohio. Sam, you've got the Detroit assembly line in Michigan. You've got the Oshawa assembly line in Ontario, Canada. This is the biggest restructuring for America's number one automaker since its bankruptcy a decade ago. What do you see in this announcement, Sam?
Well, I think the big thing to look at is the products that were being built at these 3 plants. You know, all 3 of these plants are focused on car production, particularly small car production, small and mid-sized car production, which is a segment that overall has been shrinking pretty dramatically over the last 4 or 5 years in the U.S. as consumers have shifted over to buying SUVs and crossovers and pickup trucks. And all of GM's plants that are producing those products are coming along at, you know, near full capacity. You know, these 3 plants have been building products that consumers have shown they don't want, and other manufacturers have already discontinued similar products. Ford made their announcement earlier this year that they were going to stop selling most of their car models in North America, the Focus and the Fiesta and eventually the Fusion as well. Fiat Chrysler announced 2 years ago that they were dropping the Dodge Dart and the Chrysler 200. It's just the reality of the marketplace.
So the Cruze is going the way. The Volt Hybrid is going the way to Cadillac, CT6, the Buick LaCrosse. Michelle Nix, I'm reading about this shift to more investment in electric and autonomous vehicles. Is that what you're hearing?
Yes, that's what we're hearing. And Congressman Tim Ryan from the 13th District is saying that they're ready to get on board with anything that GM wants to change. There's been a lot of investment in the Lordstown plant as far as money and other things, including solar and the paint shop, some other things. And he is hoping that GM will just tell them what they want. And, you know, it is easier to upgrade a plant when no one is in that plant. And if that's what they want to do, then he says, go for it. Do what you need to do. The workers are ready. You know, just drive it home. I mean, give them something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
They are ready to do whatever GM needs them to do. They just feel like they are kind of getting screwed in this whole deal. I mean, there was a bailout of, you know, GM, and the American workers just feel like they need a chance to prove themselves. The Lordstown workers feel like they have met every you know, obstacle that GM has put before them, and they've met every standard and exceeded every standard, and now they just feel like they need an opportunity to prove themselves again that they can be the best, and they've shown that they've been the best at every turn, and they know that these small cars, you know, are having a tough time, but they don't feel that, you know, that's something that they should be punished for.
Here's President Trump before leaving the White House yesterday telling reporters that he had harsh words for General Motors CEO Mary Barra when he spoke with her about all this.
I am not happy with what she did. You know, the United States saved General Motors, and for her to take that company out of Ohio is not good. I think she's going to put something back in soon. That car is not selling. It's a Cruze, Chevy Cruze. It's not selling. But hopefully she's going to come back and she's going to put something. But I told her I'm not happy about it.
President Trump, I'm not happy, Sam. And he urged Mary Barra, GM, to get back into Ohio somehow to maybe even repurpose one of those plants. I mean, is that even possible, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. You know, as Michelle mentioned, you know, all three of these plants have been designated as non-allocated for now. They don't have any product. They're not scrapping the plants. They're not going to pull them down. They're not selling them off at this time. They're just mothballing them, essentially, which, you know, and they've done this in the past as well. Not very often, but back, you know, when they went through their bankruptcy, when they shut down the Saturn division, they mothballed their Spring Hill, Tennessee plant and, you know, put it on non-allocated status. And they eventually brought that back a couple of years later to produce crossovers, to produce the Chevy Traverse and some other crossovers. And that plant is running now, you know, producing those products. So, you know, there is absolutely a chance for both for Lordstown and for the Detroit Hamtramck plant. I think the Oshawa plant is probably never going to see another product again. But one or possibly both of those plants, the U.S. plants, could see additional production in the next couple of years as GM brings out all of these electric vehicles that they promised last year. There's going to be a bunch of new product coming from them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things we have to look at, you know, when we complain about GM shutting down these plants, you know, after, you know, the U.S. bailed them out 10 years ago, you know, part of the reason why they needed to have a bailout and go through bankruptcy was because they weren't properly managed before, and they kept in, you know, unprofitable products and unprofitable plants running far too long, you know, which basically drove the company into the ground. You know, at some point, you know, while I have, you know, I'm a sympathizer with unions and a sympathizer with workers, and, you know, people obviously need jobs, but, you know, obviously a business has to be able to run, you know, efficiently. And, you know, if you see that you've got products that consumers aren't buying, you know, you have to make those hard decisions at some point in order to avoid getting back into that same cycle that we had 10 years ago and going back through bankruptcy, you know, so you have to allocate your resources so you can develop those future products.
Well, and interestingly, GM's stock price rose nearly 6% on this news. So investors seem to approve on some level of the company's move to cut costs. I've got a lot more callers in here. Let's get Dave in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
The only comment that I really had was I don't necessarily see it as GM seeing a future economic downturn so much as all the auto manufacturers have pretty much pinpointed the market that people aren't buying the small cars anymore or the sedans. They're going after, even though the cost is $70,000, $80,000 for SUVs and pickup trucks, people are still going after the higher rent vehicles, and that's what they're after. Their market for.
Yeah, the SUVs, the pickup trucks. Dave, thank you so much. Here is Dave Green, the president of United Auto Workers Local 1112 in Warren, Ohio, during a press conference yesterday, talking about how the future is unclear for the Lordstown Assembly Plant.
They told us that we will be in a non-allocated plant status. So we asked that question, right? Where do we go from here? And they said that General Motors does not know yet. I felt like somebody kicked me in the stomach.
Michelle Nix, before any plants can close, GM has to reach a deal with the United Auto Workers Union. Are they vowing to fight here? Sounds like it.
They are vowing to fight. I mean, they are just hoping that they can reach some common ground and hoping that they have some leverage to move forward with. They know, however, that they are in a fight with these other plants that also have lost or have laid off workers. So it's going to be tough. I mean, they are up against the other unions, and they begin negotiating at the beginning of the year. Their contract, I believe, is up in September, but they are vowing to fight as hard as they can. One point that I also want to raise is that, you know, there are a number of suppliers that are represented by that union here in Lordstown and Trumbull County as well, and they are also going to be devastated by this if we don't get a product. And that could be, you know, up to 10,000 workers. And a lot of them don't have the opportunity to try and transfer to another plant.
Mm-hmm. It's the ripple effect, right? It's not just the job losses at the plant. It's all the secondary supporting industries as well, Michelle.
Yes, exactly. And Dave Green said that throughout Ohio, there are 30 different suppliers that supply parts to their plant. Mm. So that's huge. Mm. And $3 million approximately is what goes into the village of Lordstown as far as income tax from that plant. And $800,000 to the school district, which is about 10% of their budget. I mean, there's a lot of economic impact from all of this, let alone, you know, all the businesses that'll be impacted if people move to take a job at another plant. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot riding on this.
Let's get Bill in here from Holyoke, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. My point was going to be that we should really be taking the lead in the electric car department. Now is the time to change. The writing's on the wall as far as fossil fuels go. We have the technology. We have the battery technology. We should be putting solar panels on every roof, charging our own vehicles, and getting the military-industrial complex out of the auto business.
And doubling down on those electric cars. Bill, I hear you. Thanks very much. Let's get Andy in here from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, good. Go ahead.
I really like the comment from your guest concerning market demand. And that's really what America is built on, is what the customers really want. And unfortunately, consumers don't want what these plants are producing. And I think we also have to be careful about how the government gets involved in our economics. And maybe we could take a page out of Scandinavia as far as retraining and for these workers that are going to be displaced. I mean, that's really something that makes a lot of sense. And while these companies come up with products they're going to sell, and I have a funny feeling what you've said, it sounds like the union representation is actually mad at GM, and I think we have to rethink how we react to this bad news.
I hear it, Andy. Thank you. Speaking of, to your point of government involvement in the economics of all this, Sam, do any of these changes at GM have to do with President Trump's tariffs on U.S.-built vehicles, or is it totally separate and apart from that?
There's certainly, you know, some impact in terms of raising costs for to build these vehicles, you know, and making them less economically viable. You know, and that's something that has affected the industry as a whole. Every manufacturer is being impacted by tariffs. Ford recently announced that, you know, in the third quarter, they took $1 billion hit to their profits because of the tariffs on metals. But
the imported steel tariff, right? The imported steel tariff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steel and aluminum. So but even without the tariffs, you know, long before the tariffs were, you know, were a factor, GM was looking at, you know, eliminating some of these products and closing down some of these plants just because of the nature of the market as a whole. So, you know, I think, you know, this may have accelerated it a little bit. But, you know, GM, you know, has actually been slower. You know, they've actually held out longer in preserving these products than their competitors at Ford and Chrysler did. You know, Chrysler cut their, you know, their cars 2 years ago. Ford has been doing it this year.
Right.
So, you know, GM was kind of the last one to hang on to those types of products.
We're talking about the cuts at General Motors. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. So, Sam, do you see other automakers following suit here? I mean, Ford, for example. I mean, what are you hearing internally from these companies?
Well, Ford, you know, Ford, as I said, you know, has already cut a lot of their similar products, the Focus, the Fiesta, the Fusion, you know, will be going away in a couple of years. But, you know, they had already been planning to do that for some time, and they have allocated new products to their plants. Ford, you know, was in a position where they had a higher utilization of their plants already in terms of utilizing the capacity they had. GM, you know, was running these plants underutilized for some time. You know, Ford had already made some of those cuts, and, you know, they've put new products in. So the plant in Michigan that had been producing the Focus has just recently started building the new Ranger pickup truck, midsize pickup truck, and will soon add their new Bronco SUV. Other plants that, you know, were affected by the cars, the plant that was building the Fiesta is going to build Ford's new electric crossover starting in about 18 months. So, you know, I think that, you know, we may see, as I said before, at least one of these plants and perhaps two of them get revived in the next couple of years to produce some of these new electric vehicles that GM has promised. So there is some potential there. But, you know, I agree, you know, with the caller that, you know, we also need to, the company needs to work with the union, you know, to see how they can retrain some of these workers. And, you know, one of the things that CEO Mary Barra has talked about is, you know, shifting their workforce, you know, especially the salaried workforce, to the new skills that are going to be needed to support mobility services and supporting automated vehicles in the coming years. You know, there's very different skill sets that are going to be required for that. You know, we need technicians to handle, you know, to take care of these automated vehicles, to calibrate sensors and everything.
A lot of changes on the horizon.
Yeah, so the whole industry is transforming.
Sam Abdel-Samad, a senior analyst at Navigant Research in Detroit. Sam, thanks for helping us understand these big moves at GM. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Happy to help anytime.
And Michelle Nix, reporter for NBC affiliate 21 News, WFMJ in Youngstown, Ohio. I know you're busy today, Michelle. Thank you for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jane.
When we come back, we go to San Diego and Mexico City to talk about the migrant caravan and the mounting tensions on the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. The border crossing between Tijuana, Mexico and San Diego simmers 2 days after U.S. border guards fired tear gas on migrants there, some of whom tried to rush into the United States. More migrant caravans arrive every day. The Trump administration and Mexico's new government still don't see eye to eye on what to do. What do you think? Does the standoff on the border feel under control or like it's ready to blow? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Joining me now from member station KPBS in San Diego is Jean Guerrero. She covers the U.S.-Mexico border for KPBS. Jean, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Mexico City is Santiago Perez. He's the Wall Street Journal's deputy editor for Latin America. Santiago, great to have you.
Thank you, Jane. Hello.
Here's some sound. The Voices of America captured this audio of riot police and migrants from the caravan at the San Ysidro border over the weekend. So the situation at the U.S. port of entries has been chaotic and confusing in recent days. Jean, tell us what the latest is there on the ground right now.
So as a result of this border clash that we saw on Sunday, what we're seeing is that dozens of people are signing up to actually go back to Central America. There's a lot of fear in the main shelter where most of these caravan members are staying. And because of those fears associated with the violence and the tear gas and the fact that people didn't realize it was going to be so hard to get into the United States and that they were going to encounter so many dangers at the border, they're signing up to go home. There's a stand outside of the main migrant shelter by the International Organization for Migration, and they're assisting them with trips back. As of yesterday afternoon, there were 70 people already signed up to go home. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fear associated with that clash, and also fears associated with the animosity that the migrants are encountering, not just in the United States, but within Mexico as well. Tijuana residents going around with Make Tijuana Great Again baseball caps, sort of riffing on the idea of Make America Great Again. There's just a lot of anger about this massive influx in Tijuana.
So many are turning around. They're signing up to go back home. So they're not even getting to the point of asking for asylum. Is that right?
Exactly. Because unlike before, when you could go up to a port of entry and ask for asylum and immediately be processed and have your claims assessed, now, because of backlogs at the ports of entry, people are being asked to wait weeks, sometimes months, before they're able to even speak to a U.S. border official. And so this entails waiting in Tijuana, which currently is seeing record levels of violence due to warring cartels. And for so many reasons, including that violence and the animosity from Tijuana residents and the fact that it's just so difficult to get into the U.S., a lot of people are deciding to go home. I mean, there's still thousands of people in Tijuana and more on the way. Mm-hmm. And that's another issue, because Tijuana is running out of spaces. The main shelter was supposed to fit 2,000 people. There's more than 5,000 people. Mm. I'm sorry, nearly 6,000 people in there right now.
Here is President Trump with reporters in Palm Beach, Florida on Friday, threatening to close the U.S. border with Mexico.
We find that it gets to a level where we are going to lose control, or where people are going to start getting hurt. We will close entry into the country for a period of time until we can get it under control.
To the entire border?
The whole border. I mean, the whole border.
Santiago Perez, could President Trump seal the border if he wished? Is there precedent for that?
Well, we had a similar incident almost 3 decades ago when the U.S. government closed the border after a DEA agent was kidnapped. So there is a precedent, but it'll be quite damaging for Mexico and for the cross-border economy, mm-hmm. Considering the high, degree of integration that we have at present.
Jean, how has the U.S. government responded to these caravans? We saw the tear gas. We've seen the barbed wire. What's been the reaction in Mexico, and specifically the Mexican government, these migrants moving through their country? Are they being welcomed in these communities? Are they overwhelming these communities?
Well, they're definitely overwhelming the communities. But I did want to note that one of the responses by the U.S. government this weekend was actually they closed the San Ysidro Port of Entry, which is the busiest port of entry in the United States. They closed it for more than 5 hours. That means that the tens of thousands of people who cross the border every day to go shopping, to go to school, to work, it screeched to an absolute halt on Sunday for more than 5 hours. And I talked to people on both sides of the border who were stuck, who were trying to get through and had to wait for hours. So we already saw a closure, which had a massive economic impact on both sides, San Diego and Tijuana. And in terms of the impact in Tijuana, it's just there's just a huge division right now in society along the border in Mexico. There's people who want to help members of the caravan who are bringing out food and clothing and blankets for the families. But then you have people who are really angry about the fact that, I mean, because they're spilling out of the shelters into the streets, people sleeping on the sidewalks, on the streets, and it's creating what many people complain of as an eyesore. And they're worried that it's going to lead to more insecurity in the city when it's already seeing high levels of violence. Simply because of the fact that it's just spiraling out of control. Mm. Police officers in Tijuana say that they've had to divert resources from fighting real crime because they're trying to keep the caravan controlled or protected, for the most part, protected in this one area from members of Tijuana society who don't want them there and who have actually verbally and physically attacked them in the past. Mm.
Let's get some callers in here. Mary Jo is first in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary Jo. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. So thank you for allowing me to make a statement. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, I'd like to say that from my perspective, this is a failure of immigration policy. Because if we could strategically think of ways to make it possible for people who are seeking asylum or who want to enter the United States to actually go to embassies, it would be much cheaper and actually more effective, because if you go to the embassy, you can bring the required paperwork. I mean, it's much cheaper to staff the embassies with people who would actually understand what would be required to enter the United States, and it would be easier to get a better sense of who the applicants are, what their backgrounds are, whether they actually have a justifiable case. But this isn't so much a military issue. It's more a failure of strategic policy. And so both Democrats and Republicans really need to put their heads together and think of ways to create a magnet for people to stay in their countries until they really know whether they have a viable, justifiable option of and hope of getting in the United States. And also it's much easier for every single agency that's involved. So,
Mary Jo, thank you. These are great points. I do appreciate your call. Santiago, jump back in here, because you have talked about and written about how President Trump has vowed to keep the migrants on Mexican soil while they apply for asylum or while they're there. Has the U.S. made a deal with Mexico that would keep these asylum seekers south of the border as their claims are processed or not?
Well, we don't have a formal deal, in part because, you know, President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador takes office on Saturday. So in order to formalize an agreement, he first needs to become president. Then I think there are a lot of details that still need to be sorted out. Basically, what Mexico wants is faster processing for these migrants, so they won't be in Mexico for, say, months. Which is highly complicated because what's the capacity for the U.S. government to do that? Also, what's Mexico getting in exchange? Are they getting financial support to take care of these people? There are also legal implications. Would this violate international law and treaties for dealing with asylums? So there are a lot of unanswered questions at this stage. Having said that, what the president-elect wants is to launch a development plan for Central America and southern Mexico. So the idea would be to invest in infrastructure projects as part of, like, you know, a development plan that will foster employment and offset the pressure for these people to try to go to the U.S. and find work or look for asylum.
President Trump tweeted this: Mexico should move the flag-waving migrants, many of whom are stone-cold criminals, back to their countries. Do it by plane, do it by bus, do it any way you want, but they are not coming into the United States. Here's a clip from Fox and Friends. This is yesterday. This is in response to host Steve Doocy's statements that the migrants decided to cross the border over the weekend because they were, quote, frustrated.
You know who else is frustrated? American citizens who feel like their border's been wide open for two decades. And this is one flashpoint that we're seeing and a president finally taking it serious. But there's another 2,000 miles of our border without walls, without this folks' intention, where thousands of people are literally running across the border and we have no idea who they are.
So,
In relation with what Trump said, the Mexican government has helped 2,000 migrants go back home since the caravan began in mid-October. 98 migrants were deported yesterday because of this incident. So there is some effort on the Mexican side to control the crowd. But having said that, one of the problems is that, you know, you don't have a vertical leadership within these groups. So it's very difficult to negotiate with them or to reach an agreement about what to do, how to proceed, how to organize these people. These are loosely organized groups, so the situation is quite challenging on that front as well.
Well, that's interesting. Jean Guerrero, who is organizing these caravans? I mean, they are loosely organized, but they had to start somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, from my conversations with people, it was mostly spread through word of mouth. They saw things on the news, on TV, about the fact that there was going to be this mass exodus. They heard on social media. So there was not one group organizing it, but it just sort of spread this idea of this caravan just spread like wildfire throughout Central America, and everybody just started joining up. But the thing is, I wanted to add, because based on this idea of creating a place for them to wait in Mexico, one of the biggest problems with that is the fact that they're encountering so much animosity towards the migrants within Mexico. A desire to not have the caravan among many Americans, there's also a lot of racism and xenophobia within Mexico itself, particularly towards Central Americans. You have big groups, Mexicans against the caravan forming in Tijuana, and that's going to create a major issue, especially as the numbers continue to grow along the border. Tijuana does not have the resources, nor do other border towns to deal with this influx of people. So it's going to be interesting to see how Mexico is going to be able to collaborate with the United States on this plan, given the limited resources.
Here's a clip from last night on CNN. The head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Kevin McAleenan, described the situation before the tear gas was used against those migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. Here's that.
People throwing rocks right next to women and children. They did that actually behind members of the media as well. I've seen video of a scene where rock throwers are hiding behind camera people taking photographs of them while they're throwing the rocks. So it was a really dynamic, challenging situation that our agents tried to resolve as safely as possible and were really successful overall.
Jean, the U.S. military, has been deployed to the border, nearly 6,000 troops. Talk about their involvement there briefly. And does the military have authorization to use lethal force in this case?
Yes. So they're supposed to be basically assisting and supporting Border Patrol with its own efforts. And the Trump administration did give the military permission to use force in cases where they have rocks thrown at them. In this case on Sunday with the clash that we saw, it was Border Patrol using the tear gas, and I think it's important to make it clear that when this huge group of people from the caravan went up to the border, the intention of most of the people in that group was not to necessarily storm the border. A lot of them were there because they wanted to march and raise awareness about the fact that they have to wait weeks to ask for asylum, not to storm the border. But there were unruly members among them who started throwing rocks, who started climbing and getting through the fence. And that's when things sort of spiraled out of control and you saw the authorities responding. Mm.
So dozens of these migrants are signing up to go back home, Gene, reporting. Santiago, what are you seeing here? Where do we go from here? What do you anticipate in the next week or so with these caravans?
Well, first we need to see whether the new administration will take the initiative and in the first place try to provide additional aid, support,
in Mexico,
shelter capacity, in Tijuana. And I think the Mexican government also needs to intensify talks with the U.S. and see if there's a way to improve the situation, which is deteriorating rapidly, as Gene says.
Gene, wrap us up here then. What do you anticipate in the next week or so moving forward with these caravans?
I mean, I anticipate that more and more people are going to sign up to go back home. I was actually surprised by the number of people who said they were going to go back home because they didn't expect it to be so hard to get into the United States. I think just the diversity of the members of the caravan, it's impossible to predict what they're going to do. There's people who told me that they're going to cross illegally because of the fact that it's so hard. Others want to go home. Mm. Others are going to sit around and wait as long as it takes to get into the U.S. because they're terrified of the alternative, which is to go back to their homes where they are fleeing violence.
A dynamic and difficult situation. Gene Guerrero covers the U.S.-Mexico border for KPBS in San Diego. Santiago Perez for the Wall Street Journal. Many thanks to both of you. And listeners, thanks for your calls this entire hour. We do appreciate it. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.